right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Dave DeCamp again. He is assistant news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com and also at original.antiwar.com. Find his opinion pieces in the right-hand margin there. Welcome back. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. Important things to talk about, starting with the single most important thing in the world, and that's not opinion. It's a scientific fact. Presuming the importance of the continued existence of humanity at all to you. Seems like a probably commonly accepted premise. America and Russia are in the midst of nuclear arms talks in Vienna, Austria. Tell me every single thing you know and have to say about it, please, sir.
Well, okay, so the U.S. and Russia, they met for talks this week, Monday and Tuesday, in Vienna. As the New START treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, is set to expire in February 2021. And that's the last major arms control agreement between the United States and Russia. And that limits the amount of nuclear warheads that they can have deployed. And also, importantly, it includes a verification regime, which allows up to 18 on-site inspections per year, meaning the U.S. can go inspect Russia's nukes, and Russia can go inspect the U.S. And Russia has offered to extend this treaty because it could be extended for 5 years if both sides agree. And the Trump administration has rejected that, saying that they want China to be involved. So they keep inviting China to these talks. And now you got to look at the nuclear arsenals of all these countries. So the stockpile for Russia and the United States, it's around 6,000 for each, and that's including old warheads that are set to be, like, dismantled. Their stockpiles of active warheads right now, the U.S. has about 3,800. Russia has about, I think, 4,300, somewhere around there. Now, China, current estimates put their stockpile at 320, which is, you know, significantly smaller. So China has no interest in participating in these talks, and they've said it over and over again. So when the talk started on Monday, Marshall Billingsley, he's Trump's envoy for arms control. He posted a photo on Twitter, kind of like a cheap stunt, of empty chairs with like Chinese flags around them, saying, "Oh, China's a no-show, and you know, they're still secretly building nukes." But like China told Billingsley and the United States, everybody knew that they weren't going to show up. They have no interest in participating in these talks, but the U.S. still is keeping the conversation about China and Russia.
I mean, is there anything honest about that? That they're really trying to strong arm the Chinese into joining the talks, or they really just, this is the most obvious charade as a poison pill, sort of an excuse to screw up the talks with the Russians? It has nothing to do with China at all.
That's what it looks like to me, because, like I said, I mean, just the difference in the amount of nukes that they have. And it's expected that China can double their arsenal within the next 10 years, which would put their stockpile in at 600-something. And right now, the New START treaty limits the amount of warheads that they can have deployed at like 1,550, which even if China doubles their arsenal, it doesn't even come close to that. I mean, you know, and Russia has said it's unrealistic. They kind of seem annoyed by this whole stunt by the U.S. because their argument is, okay, well, let's get France involved because France has 300 warheads. Let's get Britain involved. The U.K. has about just over 200, I think. So, yeah, I really just think it's just a charade. And, I mean, it makes sense to get if you want to talk to China about nuclear arms control. But, I mean, the U.S. would have to make a real big statement and really start dismantling their stockpile if they want to work on it with China, or, you know, reducing their stockpile. But it doesn't seem like there's anything honest about it to me. talks are over for now. They only lasted 2 days. Not many details have come out. The U.S. is still saying they want China involved. Russia's, you know, saying it's unrealistic. And they're supposed to start again at the end of July. And they established what they call, like, working groups. So the idea is they want to replace the New START with something else. But I just don't see it happening.
Yeah. Well, now, was there any discussion, do you know, about the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty or the Open Skies Treaty, both of which have now been abandoned?
Yeah, no, in these new talks, not that I heard. But yeah, that's a good thing to bring up. The Open Skies Treaty, which the Trump administration just announced they're withdrawing from, which allows surveillance over the signatories' countries, which is U.S. and Russia and many other countries. A lot of NATO countries have signed on to it. And the INF Treaty, which prohibited the development of nuclear and ballistic missiles, you know, medium-range nuclear and ballistic missiles, which the Trump administration pulled out of. You know, they always cite Russian violation, but it doesn't look like they ever try to really negotiate. Because, I mean, the Pentagon was developing those missiles that were banned under the INF. Like, the next week, they were testing them. And now they're actually trying to put them around China. So, it's become a much more dangerous world.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, if it's true, and apparently it is, I guess, I don't know, best information is maybe there really is something to the idea that the Russians were violating the treaty by creating these medium-range missiles, but they were deploying them along their frontier with China, and they had not introduced them into Eastern Europe at all. I mean, obviously that could change, but it didn't seem like it was just a loophole for them to invent medium-range missiles to get around their treaty with the U.S. It was because, I mean, they don't need long-range missiles for China. They share a frontier there, you know? And so, but then the Americans, it was quite clear. In fact, Chas Freeman, who's authoritative on this issue, who was with Nixon when they shook hands with Mao Zedong and opened up China, he was saying that, yes, it's right that the Americans wanted out of the INF treaty so that they too could confront China with these intermediate range nuclear missiles, which, you know, I'm no nuclear war strategist, but I don't see what difference that makes compared to America's pre-existing ability to nuke China with submarines or long range missiles or bombers or whatever we want anyway. So they're willing to risk reintroducing intermediate range missiles into Europe and escalating the nuclear arms race with Russia in Europe, because both America and Russia want these nukes for confronting China. It's completely bananas.
Yeah.
There's a few hundred million people in Europe who might dispute that that's worth it, you know?
Yeah.
About
yeah.
that.
And then, but back to this Marshall Billingsley guy who's heading these talks, you know, he's not sending the best signals to Russia. Before the talks, he said that if a new nuclear arms race starts, that the U.S. is prepared to spend Russia and China into oblivion, was the quote. He doesn't seem too interested in actually making a deal here. And another thing that happened earlier this month, it was revealed last week, was the Senate Armed Services Committee. They put aside $10 million in their version of the NDAA, the yearly Pentagon spending bill, to resume live nuclear testing, which is alarming. Because there was a story in the Washington Post in May that the Trump administration was discussing doing live tests. Some people dismissed it because, like, the preparation to actually go into that is a lot. But this is a little, this was Tom Cotton's idea, which is no surprise. So this is the Senate's version of the NDAA. It might, and then the Senate and the House, you know, they have to negotiate their version, what goes to Trump's desk. This might have some pushback in the House, the money for the live test, but yeah, it's definitely alarming. It looks like we're gearing up for a new nuclear arms race here.
Yeah, I love that whole thing about spin them into oblivion. Is that a thing? A country can be spent into oblivion, huh? And yeah, we've seen that happen before. Is that right? And
yeah,
we know that that can't happen here because what? Because why? Anyway, yeah, me and my bad grammar. Hey man, you guys are gonna love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to ExpandDesigns.com/Scott. And say $500. All right, let's talk about one of our many wars in the Middle East, this time Yemen. And in fact, this is the sub-war within the Yemen war. This is the split between the southern separatists, the Southern Transitional Council, as it's called, and their UAE allies. Who had an alliance previously with the Saudi and American-backed Hadi government, but then they've had some troubles and back again. Can you fill us in there?
Yeah, there's been a lot of fighting between the STC and Hadi's government. The biggest battle, it looks like, was the island of Socotra, if I'm saying that right. The STC took it from the Hadi government, and you know they raised their flag of South Yemen, the former country that was disbanded in 1990 when North and South turned into the Yemen, the borders that we know today. And then it seemed like the Saudis brokered a ceasefire because they don't want to have to deal with these guys in the South while they're having so much trouble with the Houthis. Jason just wrote a story yesterday on Thursday that it looks like that ceasefire did not last long, and I think at least 54 fighters were killed in the southern province Abyan, which is where the STC are. So it looks like they still have a big headache in the south there, the Saudis and the Saudi-backed government that they're fighting to reinstate. The war is not going well for them.
And then, I mean, when we say the Hadi government, is there actually land that they control anywhere?
Yeah, there is. There is land that they control. They technically control Aden, the port city of Aden.
I mean, when they have an alliance with the STC, they do, right?
That's true. Yeah. No, it's real. It is complicated.
They occupy the Radisson in Riyadh.
Yeah. Well, Hadi does.
Rebels have ruled the capital city for 5.5 years now, but they're still rebels. And the guy hiding in a hotel in another country is the government there.
Yeah. And
we all know that.
It's important to know that the area under Houthi control, that's where 70% of the population is. And there's been a lot of aid cuts lately. The World Food Program, USAID, and the UN cut a lot of programs. And I know it might seem kind of silly. It's like the United States is the country that is causing the crisis there and also giving them aid. But when you have a population, I mean, it's like 80% of them are reliant on this aid. And the blockade on the country, like they need it, or people are going to really, I mean, people are dying, people are starving, but these aid cuts are no good when you have such a big population relying on it.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the annexation of the West Bank, which is imminent now. Was the 26th we're talking here. Mm-hmm. And they say on the 1st of July. they're going to outright annex how much of the West Bank, Dave?
Well, so the Trump peace plan, the amount of land allocated to Israel in the Trump peace plan, so peace in quotes there, was the parts of the Jordan Valley and the settlements, most of the settlements, the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, which, and it made up about 30% of the West Bank. And now Netanyahu, he wants to do the whole thing, you know, unilateral annexation of those areas. But he's having trouble with Benny Gantz, who's the defense minister. And they brokered a power sharing deal after there's like three back-to-back elections and that put neither one in power. So Gantz is set to take over next year. And for the United U.S. officials have said for Netanyahu to get the green light, he needs to work it out with Gantz. And Gantz is a little more cautious. Yeah, he's not. He wants the same areas to be under, you know, Israeli sovereignty. He wants to annex the same areas, but he wants to do it more cautiously. He's worried about the King Abdullah in Jordan and peace treaties with Egypt and kind of inflaming the region because, you know, that's going to happen. If Israel takes all that land, it's going to be, there's a lot of violence is going to erupt. And then there was meetings this week between, you know, Kushner and Friedman and all the U.S. officials involved in this, Pompeo. I think Trump was involved. And it looks like nothing publicly really came out. They were supposed to make a decision. Apparently they did it. But, I mean, I was reading on Mondo Weiss that it looks like they did come to a decision. You know, some sources were saying that it looks like they're going to start with just two settlement blocks for now. So it's going to be kind of a gradual thing, which was a big, which was under consideration the whole time. That's kind of what Gantz was saying, like a process of annexation.
Yeah. Establishing facts on the ground, they call it. So, but I mean, that would make a bit of difference if, you know, public relations wise, I guess, if they slow it down and do it in smaller steps here. I read just a headline, so I won't characterize the article too badly because I don't know exactly what it said. But I just noticed a headline, I think at the Washington Post, you know, opinion page, where they were saying that, you know, if this happens, then the Palestinians, the danger is that they will be deprived of hope. And then, of course, you know, I don't know how cynical the actual piece was, but the reality of that is, of course, the word false should be in brackets right there before hope. And the point being that the Palestinians might be driven to absolute despair at this point, where now they no longer buy the propaganda campaign that someday, if they just hold their horses, they'll get their Palestinian state. And now that they'll know that they will never have independence, then they'll have nothing to lose and things will get worse for Israel. You know, that's, of course, the way it's all framed. But
yeah,
seems
yeah,
like there's a real concern, danger that, right? Like, why not have another intifada at that point?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, they will have nothing to lose at that point. And that does seem to be the concern because some Democrats are speaking out about annexation. But it's all about how it's going to affect Israel. It's not that they really care about the Palestinians.
Yeah, it goes to show how cynical the entire Oslo process has been and the remnants of it and the different so-called, you know, peace process campaigns under Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and all the way through right now. It's all a hoax.
Yeah. And then there's so many things at play, too. Like, a lot of the settler, like, leaders, they don't think Trump's plan is enough because they don't want to be in, like, what they call enclaves. They don't want to be in Israeli sovereign territory surrounded by Palestinian territory. And that, you know, they don't want a Palestinian state at all. And Netanyahu has said, if he goes through with the full annexation, no Palestinians are going to become Israeli citizens and there will be no like state. And he won't. And one of the concessions Israel is supposed to make under the plan was a settlement freeze for like 4 years. And he says there's going to be no settlement freeze. So, I mean, Netanyahu just wants the land and wants to just continue to creep into the rest of the territory in the West Bank. And I mean, what the Palestinians are desperate. I mean, this plan is just ridiculous. If you look at the map, there's like Israeli only roads going through the West Bank, and it's just, it really just like makes apartheid rule official, you know?
Right. Which is a major, you know, rhetorical change anyway. I mean, life, I don't know how much it's really going to change for the people in Palestine, but, you know, it's not just the Palestinians who've been put off by this narrative of the two-state solution. It's, you know, the governments of Western Europe have at least hid behind it, of course, and American liberal Zionist Jews who support the state of Israel, but who don't support the subjugation of the Palestinians, have been able to have it both ways for now 30 years since, or more, what, yeah, 30 years almost since Oslo, saying that, well, yeah, no, look, what's happening is wrong, but we could fix it if only we just didn't have Sharon or didn't have Netanyahu or whoever the problem is at this or that particular point. But someday, once they have independence, then it'll be fine, and we can have our Israel, or the Israelis can have their Israel, and the Palestinians can have their Palestine. But now they can't really hide behind believing that anymore. Because now it's like, oh, well, as you just said, it's cranking up the official status of the apartheid system there. What do you do when Israel takes all the land and they take all the people too? I mean, they're essentially kidnapped. What the hell is going on here? And how is anybody supposed to rationalize it now that they can't hide behind the Oslo process that really broke down back in 1995 and which wasn't really going to grant them a Palestinian state anyway, if you look closely at it. But still, I mean, so now the game is up as far as that goes. And so what effect that has on liberal Zionists and liberal Zionism in America, I think we're only going to just be at the start of seeing what happens with that. But it should matter a lot to the Zionist consensus inside the United States, certainly according to what they've been saying all this time. You know, not the right wing hawks, but the more liberal Zionist organizations. In fact, even AIPAC has officially supported a two-state solution all along. So I guess it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. And then there's another thing at play here is there's a possibility that Netanyahu might call for new elections, because there's some polls that show if there was a new election, his bloc in the Knesset would get enough seats for him to form a government without Gantz. There's a story Likud sources told, like the Jerusalem Post, that, you know, they were kind of,
They would be absolutely nuts to do that again now. Oh my God.
They would.
Although, what a circus, right? And what a better way to get out of that trial again, too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, Netanyahu, if he doesn't pull off the annexation, he can blame it on the Gantz's blue and white party. If he does pull it off, he'll probably get a lot more support. So, like, that's all at play, too, here. Because I know, like, the Likud party, they want to disband that coalition government, according to, you know, the sources that speaking to Israeli media, like they don't want anything to do with that coalition government, apparently.
I don't know, man. I mean, he's already
election. Yeah, true.
That'd be crazy for him to do that. And as you were saying before, Gantz is compliant enough. It's not like he's some kind of hero for Palestinian independence or anything here.
No, he said the other day the Palestinians were taking too long to
accept their subjugation.
They weren't. Oh, yeah, what? Yeah, they weren't just complaining how they weren't coming to the negotiating table. And he said something like Palestinians are in deep shit, and I don't want any part of it. So he's definitely not a hero for the Palestinians.
Yeah,
I
remember when they were both running. In his first election ads, bragged about reducing Gaza, quote, to the Stone Age.
Yeah.
Helpless, defenseless, imprisoned Gaza.
Yep. Yeah, that's the kind of guy he is. He's just a little smarter.
He's a moderate, see? He's a moderate rebel.
Yeah.
He's a moderate Israeli leader.
He's more diplomatic than Netanyahu. That's really it.
Yeah, don't make me dig up Ariel Sharon.
Yeah,
see, that's the threat, right? Gotta settle. Mm-hmm. Good for these guys. All right, now, and speaking of Israel and the Israel lobby in the United States. Let's talk about these crushing new sanctions on Syria.
Oh, yeah.
Which, well, by the way, everybody, I think you picked up on the narrative here that Dave has stories on all these stories at news.antiwar.com. Go ahead.
Yeah, so these new sanctions under the CSAR Act, we've ran a lot of stories on them at antiwar.com. A lot of good people writing about it. So right now, before these new sanctions took effect, our U.S. sanctions blocked the assets of Syrians in Syria trying to rebuild the country. And these new sanctions can target anybody, regardless of nationality, who's investing in the country for the what they call the corrupt reconstruction effort. So it's dangerous, and it's driven a lot of investors out of Syria. It's really having to put a squeeze on Lebanon. It's discouraging the regional neighbors like Lebanon and Jordan and Iraq to help the reconstruction effort after the almost, you know, 9-year war that ripped apart that country. And it's just, and it's like specifically targeting construction and energy sectors. It's like for the purpose of not letting Assad rebuild. The first round of these new sanctions, I forget exactly who they went against. I know one of them was on Assad's wife. But yeah, it's just really brutal. After all those years of war, now the United States is going to do anything they can to not let them rebuild the country. And it's just a shame. And including keeping troops in eastern Syria there, stealing their oil. And
where's that oil going, by the way? The Americans are funneling it off to Turkey, or what are they? They're just sitting on it, or what?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure.
And it's certainly keeping it out of the hands of Damascus.
Yeah, we're definitely not making any money on it. There's been a lot of good stuff written about it. Daniel Larrison at the American Conservative wrote a good story. People want to look for more detail, but it hurts. You know, I mean, there was a story that we ran. There was Syrian Americans protesting in Allentown, Pennsylvania, the sanctions, because they can't send money home. They're not going to be able to send money home now.
Yeah.
To their family, which is just cruel.
You know, there's I guess I got to find the time to read this stupid thing, man. This John Bolton book. I got the PDF of it, but I did read one news story about it where they talked about this conflict. I like it when they talk about it in stark terms, because it's very rare you could read a piece in the Times or the Post where they really are frank about this, where, look, we have a real split between, for example, General Mattis, who is the Secretary of Defense, the Marine Corps general. He wanted to kill Islamic State guys. And he's an Iran hawk. Nobody ever confused him for not being one. He got fired for being too much of an Iran hawk in the Obama years. All right. But his thing was, let's kill ISIS guys. And there's this giant push by Bolton and the others and Pompeo and the others in the administration that, no, when we're in Syria, essentially, this is the part they don't say out loud, we're on ISIS's side. The enemy is Iran. And, you know, their friends in Hezbollah and the Syrian government. And that's who ought to be the target there. But it's not just the biggest bait and switch in the world from one thing to another, but it's from one thing to its opposite, where it's, again, you know, essentially helping to accomplish the goals of the bin Ladenites by fighting against their worst enemies, when not outright providing direct aid to them, which was part of the story, too, of course. But always, you know, essentially taking their side in that thing. And but it's just great because, you know, TV usually, with TV, you'll never explain it. And the Post and the Times will very rarely explain that, okay, here are the sides. And ironically, here's whose side we're on, or anything like that, you know. But that a bit of that is coming out in the Bolton book.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's tough to know what's true and what's not true, but I think there's a story in the National Interest about that stuff.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, our troops are right now, they're not fighting the Islamic State at all. They're there keeping the oil out of the hands of the Assad government.
Yeah, and James Jeffrey, the U.S. envoy to Syria, recently said that his goal is to make a quagmire for Russia in Syria. So.
Oh, he said that again? Who said that? Oh, James Jeffrey said that?
Yeah,
how recently did he say that?
That was a few months ago.
Oh, Man, hang on. I got to write that down and make sure and find that.
Yeah, because he's, I mean, you know, the stated goal for the U.S. is to prolong the war and not let the country rebuild.
You know, they started talking like that as soon as Russia intervened in 2015. They're like, ha, 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 it'll be just like Afghanistan for them. And like, it'll be just like what?
Yeah.
It'll be just like Afghanistan, the place where we've been bogged down in the quagmire for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. It'll be just like that. Well, at that point, 15 years. These people, you know, well, we're still in Afghanistan. And they're going, yeah, we're going to bog them down and give them a quagmire like we did in Afghanistan in the 80s. Like we're doing to ourselves in Afghanistan right now. Still. Yeah. I would not hire these people to run my national government, Dave. You picking up the thread here? No, they're not good at it. Not by my lights.
No. There was a recent U.S. airstrike in like northwest Syria in the Idlib province against the Al-Qaeda guy. And it's like that's kind of a perfect encapsulation of U.S. foreign policy. Like we're working, you know, supporting Turkey to support those rebels in Idlib to fight Russia in Syria, but also drone bombing some of them. It's like,
yeah, and picking off just one guy that we kind of don't like. He's not so moderate. Let's get him. But the rest are cool. Jolani's still okay. Nobody seems to be too bothered by, in fact, the entire presence of what's a mini Islamist state there in the Idlib province. You know, when ISIS declared their caliphate, that was the biggest deal in the world. The Idlib province or major portions of it are still just Al-Qaeda stan, and that's been the status quo for, what, 3 years or something now?
Yeah, and that's even,
and
like,
Turkey's preventing, you know, Russia and the Syrian government from ending that situation, of course.
Mm-hmm. And that's been, like, even in the mainstream press now, like, they call him Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
It's not even a secret anymore. Like, the Associated Press, I read a lot, they always call you know, Al-Qaeda-linked groups.
That's Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is al-Nusra, which is al-Jolani, which is al-Zawahiri, the butcher in New York City.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm not saying that America should carpet bomb them or anything like that, but for us to be on their side, that would seem to be, you know, counterproductive for American security needs. All right, listen, I'm sorry, man. I'm late and I got to go. But thank you so much for coming back on the show, Dave. Great stuff.
Yeah, Scott. Thanks for having me.
All right, see you, man. The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.